The Laura Murphy Show, episode 27.
Welcome to The Laura Murphy Show, the podcast that analyzes financial markets from the perspective of Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept. Listen and learn as your hosts, Robert Murphy and Carlos Lara, explain how you can be part of building the 10%.
Hello, everyone. This is Bob Murphy, one half of the hosts for The Laura Murphy Show. We are going to play for this episode 27 and then episode 28. We're going to split it up into two separate components. Carlos and I recently recorded a video message talking about the state of the U.S. economy, and specifically the financial storms we see on the horizon and strategies households and business owners can use to protect themselves from those storms. So we thought it would make sense here at the Laura Murphy Show to release that in bite-sized chunks. It's about an hour and 2 minute total presentation, so we're splitting it up into two episodes here for 27 and 28. Of course, if you listen to this episode 27 now, which is going to be the first half, and you're just dying to hear the rest of the message, you can go ahead and look at the show notes page for episode 27. Just go to lauramurphy.com in the podcast section. You can look it up in the archives, and we'll have a link to the actual video presentation. There's also going to be some slides that you'll hear us alluding to, so you are missing a little bit of it if you're listening to it on the audio, but we wanted to get this information out in as many formats as possible. Let me also mention some upcoming events. Carlos and I, as well as Nelson Nash, the founder and discoverer of IBC, are going to be presenting in two different places in the near future. So on Saturday, October 29th, and we're in 2016, we are going to be at a workshop intended for the general public talking about IBC, and that's going to be in Spokane, Washington. All right, so if you're in that area and you have never, particularly if you've never heard Nelson Nash speak, then we encourage you to check that out. The information is going to be at the show notes page for this podcast. And then November 15th through 17th, the three of us are going to be participating in the Freedom Advisor event, which is intended for financial professionals, and that's going to be in St. Louis. So again, just to repeat, Saturday, October 29th, Nelson, Carlos, and I are going to be in Spokane, Washington. And so if you're a member of the general public, that presentation is going to be geared towards you. November 15th through 17th, we're going to be in St. Louis participating in an event. And there, that's intended for financial professionals. So if you're interested in either of those, go ahead and look at the show notes page again. This is episode 27. If you want to look this up at lauramurphy.com and see the links for how you get more information on either of these events or the link to our video presentation that Carlos and I gave in late September 2016 on the coming financial storms and how to weather them. So we hope you enjoy it, although it's partly depressing. But hey, we give you strategies for how to cope with it. Welcome, everyone. I'm economist Robert Murphy, and this is business consultant Carlos Lara. We're broadcasting from Nashville, Tennessee. It's late September 2016. And what we're going to be talking about is the coming financial storms and strategies you can use to protect yourself from them. Now, just to give you some introductory background here, Carlos and I have been touring the country, giving public talks. We've written a book. We have a podcast. We have a website set up, lauramurphy.com, devoted to disseminating this information, but we thought it was important for us to come condense it down into a brief message to give to you in this format. So I should say that a lot of what we're going to talk about tonight, just because of the constraints of time, we have to condense it down into very bite-sized chunks. But if any of this whets your appetite and you want to learn more, we're going to provide you with plenty of material for further information. Just to give you a little bit more of a background on how we came together and why we're now here giving you this message, I should explain that I originally moved to Nashville back in 2006. I was working in the financial sector, but I had also been in the academic sector. I had been touring, writing books on Austrian economics, and it just so happened that Carlos was at that time going through and trying to learn more about the banking system, and he was using a study guide I had written for Murray Rothbard's work, and he saw in the back that I lived in Nashville, and so that's how we came to meet each other. And at that time, Carlos introduced me
to the work of Nelson Nash, particularly this book, Becoming Your Own Banker. And we're going to talk more about that later on. And Carlos was very much intrigued by this and asked me to investigate it. I did. The more I studied Mr. Nash's work, the more I realized that the infinite banking concept, IBC, was something that people really needed to check out and study. And then actually what happened further was Carlos and I ended up writing our own book, How Privatized Banking Really Works. And what we were just trying to do in this book was to sort of marry Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept, IBC. And the insight that we tried to put forth in this book was to say that what the Austrians were doing, they had correctly diagnosed the problem. They understood what was wrong with our financial system and how banks operated in the modern era. But the strategies they were offering to people, although they would work, they involved mass changing of public opinion and changing government and Federal Reserve policies, which that ultimately would be the true solution. But we realized a lot of people would say that's not going to happen anytime soon, and it would be lead to despair and despondency. Whereas what Nelson Nash was offering was something that individual households and business owners could do immediately without waiting to change public opinion. And so just one household or business owner at a time could effectively secede from this system. So that's what we were trying to get forth in our book. And we just came together, and that's now to give you the background as to how Carlos and I have been going around and what our joint strategy is and our mission to try to educate the American public. So I should mention as one final remark before I turn the microphone over to Carlos here that the message we're going to give is going to be bleak. And we understand there are lots of people right now warning people the end is near, doom and gloom. And some people just dismiss this all as people being perma bears and what have you. We're aware of that, and all I can say is we're going to try to be very sober in the analysis. You're going to see we're going to have a lot of facts and statistics. This is not merely an emotional plea. This is serious information. What can we do when we think things really are this dire except to warn people about the coming financial storms that we see on the horizon?
Turn to you. Thank you, Bob. Well, as Bob mentioned, I'm a consultant and a workout specialist in a firm that I established in 1976. And I got into Austrian economics after getting financially clobbered during the period of the 1986 Tax Reform Act. Now, that was soon followed in October of 1987 with Black Monday, the worst stock market crash in history up until that time. And then that crash was followed by the crashing of the residential and the commercial real estate market to a level that had never been seen before since the Great Depression of the 1930s. It was a bad time. Though my family and I suffered immensely during that period, fortunately, I did not have to file for bankruptcy. But the record shows that millions of businesses and individuals did. Now, what I most want to tell you is that none of my personal high-priced financial advisors saw any of this coming. I was 40 years old at the time. This was actually my first realization that these economic crashes don't just mysteriously happen. They're created. And this is what led me to further research and further study. And I eventually came to realize that it was these Austrians that really understood the business cycle. And that's really what brings us here together tonight, because we think that the Federal Reserve and other central banks around the world they've done it again. They've blown up a giant bubble that can't possibly be sustained much longer. Now, what we don't want to do is string you along. I'm going to tell you right now what we believe is the strategy that you should implement. And then we're going to spend the rest of this time talking to you about the exact nature of the problem and why our recommendations will help you weather the coming storm that is coming our way. So here now is the strategy that we are recommending. As you can see, it's a three-step plan, and I want to walk through each one of those steps. The first step that you should do is to begin as soon as possible to build up a stockpile of currency, cash, and have it in your possession. Now here we're talking about a minimum supply of 30 days of living expenses or operational expenses. You should have this in your possession. You should store it in some sort of a fireproof container or a safe. Step two is that you should begin purchasing gold or silver, and you should physically own it. Now here, we're recommending that you buy it not as an investment, but rather as emergency money. And you should buy it in amounts equivalent to a minimum of 6 months and up to 18 months. And then step three is that you need to move forward and set up an alternate warehouse for the remainder of your dollars. Now here we are specifically talking about Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept, or for short, IBC. And that includes a dividend paying whole life insurance contract. As Bob has already alluded, that we brought the marrying of Austrian economics and the infinite banking concept together for a purpose, which we will get into much deeper in just a little bit. But Nelson Nash's IBC involves the use of the oldest financial contract in the insurance industry, next to term insurance. That financial contract is the dividend-paying whole life insurance contract. It should be specially designed according to Nelson Nash's specifications. And it should be purchased from a mutual or a mutual holding company where the policyholders are also the owners of the company. Now, at this particular time, the primary reason for taking these important steps is because of the inherent systemic risk problems that we find with commercial banks. And that is due to fractional reserve banking in combination with the recently enacted Dodd-Frank Act. Together, these two have made keeping money in commercial banks very risky for all of us. And I will explain that in detail in just a minute. But among some of the more positive reasons why this alternative cash flow system that we're recommending is superior to the one that we're all currently using right now with banks is because of the control and ready access that we have to our money when we need it, especially when it comes to loans and lines of credit. These can be readily accessed with terms and repayment flexibility that are not found in the commercial banking system, or really anywhere else for that matter. We will explain that in detail as well. But not only do we find guarantees that are built into the IBC method, we also have tax benefits and uninterrupted compounding on the growth of our money. And that means zero market volatility. That growth on our money includes interest and even dividends that are paid to us as participants and legal owners of the mutual insurance company itself. Now, in a few minutes, I'm going to direct you and show you exactly how you can obtain one of these specially designed insurance contracts from an extensive list of authorized IBC practitioners. These licensed financial professionals are also graduates of the training program that Bob and I helped develop. We can vouch for these approximately 200 financial professionals, no one else. But before I direct you there, Bob needs to go through for a few minutes and explain to us the nature of our current economic problem and how it is being precipitated to the degree that we see these crashes coming much, much sooner than even we expected. Bob?
Thanks, Carlos. So I just want to brag on Carlos a little bit, folks, because he's being very modest here, but I do want to stress he's going to get into what he found with the Dodd-Frank Act and how that relates to commercial banks and why your money isn't safe there. And this was stuff that he dug up well before this type of stories were being broken on Zero Hedge and places like that. So this is how I knew that, okay, yes, I've teamed up with the right guy here, that his background in bankruptcy proceedings and so forth allowed him to sort of pierce the veil. Because if you've ever looked at any of this legislation, it's written in lawyer language. So average people don't even know what it's talking about. Perhaps that's why the politicians don't even read these bills before they vote on them. In any event, this stuff really is things that Carlos was onto well before even these sort of alternative sites picked up on it. And so I really do encourage you to pay attention to the warnings he's going to give. But as Carlos mentioned, we have to give you the big picture. Why is it that we think that right now we are on the cusp of another major crash in the financial sector? And again, Carlos came to this through personal experience that he got hit in the 87 crash, and then went on a personal odyssey to discover what happened. That led him to Austrian economics. I was coming from the academic world, as I mentioned, and then actually I was looking in 2007 with fresh eyes, as it were, and realized, oh wow, they really have blown up a giant bubble in the housing sector that's going to come down. So there were plenty of Austrians warning about the housing crash well ahead of time. You may be familiar with Ron Paul's warnings, for example, Peter Schiff, people like that. So what I'm going to tell you right now is just spend a few moments and let you understand how is it that people who have studied the Austrian School of Economics, why do they think they have certain insights into the nature of the business cycle? Now, I should be clear, Austrian economics, it doesn't give you a crystal ball, and some of the greatest proponents of this viewpoint, like Ludwig von Mises and Murray Rothbard, Friedrich Hayek, they would be very modest and say, look, we're not giving you a way to predict the future. That's part of the essence of Austrian economics, is to eschew mathematical formulations and to say humans are unpredictable. You can't really write down an equation to say what people are going to do tomorrow. So I want to be clear, a lot of what we're going to be telling you tonight is going to be infused with our own personal judgments, but the framework that we're using to make these judgments is Austrian economics. So let me just very briefly explain that framework. Put simply, the theory of the business cycle is developed by Ludwig von Mises and refined by his follower Friedrich Hayek, is to say that the normal boom-bust cycle that you see in market economies, that's not normal. That's not just, oh, that's capitalism for you. You have to be willing to take these downturns if you want to have the upswing. No, what Mises said is that itself is the product of government intervention. So specifically what happens is the commercial banks, and in modern times, under the guidance and the cheerleading of and the protection afforded by the central bank, the commercial banks flood the market with cheap credit that's not really connected to genuine savings. And so what that means is the interest rate that gets charged on loans is pushed artificially low. And so that gives the green light, as it were, to businesses to invest in long-term projects when really there's not enough genuine savings available physically to carry these projects to completion. So one way I like to motivate this is to say that in the Austrian view, market prices perform work. They give us information, right? That market prices really have a job to do. And so just like if the price of crude oil is $80 a barrel, that means one thing. If it's $30 a barrel, that means something else about underlying scarcity, availability, production, opportunities, and so forth, consumer preferences. those market prices mean something if we're talking about something like the price of a barrel of oil. So by the same token, the short-term interest rate, that really means something. And so if the Federal Reserve comes in and the market rate of interest ought to be 4%, and instead the Fed is stimulating or trying to encourage spending and so forth by pushing down the interest rate to 0.5%, you're not doing the economy any favors. That's the wrong price. It's giving people the wrong information. So when it comes to interest rates and credit, what's really perverse is it's not immediately obvious that it's the wrong price. What ends up happening, and this is the theory that Mises and Hayek developed, is to say if there's an artificially low interest rate, that can set up an unsustainable boom. So for a few years, as long as this boom continues, it seems like it's great. There's apparent prosperity. Workers' wages are rising, unemployment's low, businessmen are earning excessive profits, they have high dividends, they're giving bonuses to their key employees and so on. Everything seems great. Workers can quit one job, go somewhere else, get a better paying job. Everything is humming. Everybody's happy. And then for some reason, it all comes crashing down. And so again, in the Austrian story, what's happening there is that that artificial boom period is the problem. So one way to put it is to say Keynesian economists tend to focus on the downturn, the crash, and they say, why is it that all of a sudden people aren't spending enough? And then they scratch their heads and try to figure out ways to get consumers and businesses to spend more in consumption or to invest more. And gee, if they're not willing to do it, I guess the government needs to come in and just spend money. And who cares what it's on? We just got to get spending up. Whereas the Austrians say, wait a minute, why is it that all of a sudden aggregate demand collapsed? Is there something earlier that we need to look at? And so in the Austrian view, the only way to ultimately get rid of these horrible downturns is to avoid the preceding boom period. Whereas in the Keynesian view, they typically like the boom period and then just think, oh, if only we could keep that spending going on indefinitely. So that's the basic framework. Now, to give you some motivation as to why do we think right now we're in the midst of a very unsustainable boom, you're going to see a chart in front of you. So what this chart shows, I got this from the St. Louis Federal Reserve. You can go reproduce this if you'd like. This is going from January of 2009 up through the present time, September of 2016, and you'll see the blue line is the S&P 500 index. And the red line is showing what technically it's called the St. Louis adjusted monetary base, but if you just want to loosely think about it, that's sort of like the total amount of money that the Federal Reserve has been pumping into the economy. So this is like the high-powered money that the Fed directly controls. Okay, and so as you can see there, there's a few things I want you to take away from this chart. First of all, notice how closely those lines track each other. And I should just mention, in case you've never seen something like that, that's not normal. All right, I zoomed in on 2009 to the present just to get the fit to show you how closely they match. But if we took a longer term view, you would see that they don't typically line up like this. The stock market does its thing and the Fed usually wasn't doing too much. But since the rounds of so-called quantitative easing, you can see how the stock market has tracked what the Federal Reserve has been doing. So I'm trying to give additional evidence here to buttress our story, our narrative, saying this alleged recovery that's occurred during the Obama administration, we think is built on quicksand, right? That the fact that the stock market has boomed so much since the initial plunge after the financial crisis, we don't think is evidence of the great policies that the Obama administration has put into place and the wise stewardship of the Federal Reserve. On the contrary, we think that Ben Bernanke has blown up a much bigger asset bubble than Greenspan did during the housing bubble years. Right? So that's one thing I want you to take from this chart. Another thing, though, I want you to focus on, look at the two black braces that I've indicated here in those two spots, and you'll see that those are the two spots since early 2009 where the blue line and the red line have the biggest gaps. And so what that means, if you see the blue line's higher than the red line, so that's saying those are periods where, for some reason, the stock market was moving up, even though it seemed like the Fed wasn't accommodating, that the Fed hadn't been pumping in a bunch of money and yet the stock market was going up. So you saw the way that was resolved in around January of 2011 when finally that red line shot up and caught up, as it were, to where the blue line had moved up. And so my interpretation there is to say investors on Wall Street and around the world knew that the Fed was going to come in and pump in more money and have another round of QE. So that would have been QE2, right? And so, in other words, stocks started rising in anticipation that the Fed was going to bail us out, and they weren't just going to sit back and let the market crash. And so, yep, and they did. Right on cue, the Fed all of a sudden pumps in a bunch of money with QE2 there. Again, looking out at the end of this chart, and you can see as of right now, when we're giving you this message, the stock market, if you buy into this general correlation that we've seen since the beginning of the extraordinary accommodation, the stock market right now, according to this metric, is overvalued. And so the question is the Fed going to accommodate? Are they going to come in and say, okay, yeah, actually, the markets are starving for more liquidity, we need to have QE4, or is the Fed going to stay pat and say, nope, we've really done as much as we're going to do, we got to ride this thing out. So let me be clear, at this point, you know, the Austrian economics per se doesn't tell us what's going to happen over the next 12 months. What Austrian economics tells us is that if you have an unsustainable boom, it's going to come crashing down, and the things that contribute to an unsustainable boom, but it doesn't tell you timing. And in particular, people using an Austrian framework, myself included, we've been worried for years at this point that Bernanke was blowing up a giant asset bubble. But as long as they kept pumping in more and more money, the bubble kept going up higher and higher. So the question is now one of a judgment call to say, is the Fed going to come in with another burst of liquidity and pump up the bubble even more and get us a few more years? Or are they just going to say, you know what, we got to stop? So my personal judgment is there's going to be a crash before the Fed comes in with another huge burst of liquidity. And the reason for that is, number one, if you just look back at the history of new Federal Reserve chairs, there is this pattern where, I checked it going back at least to Volcker, when a Fed chair comes in, there is usually a large crash within about 2 years, and often much sooner. If you look at Greenspan, he came in and then it wasn't even a full year before you had the biggest crash, as Carlos mentioned, in history to that point. So there is this pattern. So we can explain that with both Austrian economics and there's our knowledge of how politics works. You can think about it, that it would make sense. A new Fed chair comes in dealing with the previous bubble the last person blew up, and they said, here you go, good luck with that. There's a big crash. Then what do the Fed chairs do? Well, according to the Keynesian textbooks, they cut interest rates, flood the market with liquidity, and then, oh, there's a recovery. They blow up another giant asset bubble. They start reading the writing on the wall, and they all of a sudden decide to retire and go write their memoirs and hand that mess off to the next person. So I think what happened is Bernanke came in. There was a huge crash. You know, the housing bubble collapsed. That wasn't, you know, totally his fault. That Greenspan had a lot to do with that. Then he blew up another giant bubble, realized that, and then they handed it over to Yellen, and now it's her job to oversee this big crash in as best way she can. So I don't think the Fed is going to expand until something really awful happens. And just look at a little bit of the clues here. The so-called taper, that was when QE3 wound down, right? That they had originally been buying assets at $85 billion a month and then started reducing it. That was supposed to happen in September of 2013 under Bernanke. They didn't do it. They pushed it back to December of 2013. That was when Bernanke officially stepped down. Yellen gets, the Senate confirms her in January of 2014. She's sworn in, and that's when the taper fully goes into motion. Okay, so in terms of a regime change, if you will, it really does look like Yellen comes in to oversee this switch from expansion to let's hold it pat. And in particular, the chart indicates it, but also just various other measures you can look at. A lot of people, I think even hard money types, Austrian libertarians, they have this idea, oh yeah, Bernanke and Yellen have been inflating like crazy. No, Bernanke inflated like crazy, but if you look at certain metrics, Yellen actually has been overseeing just holding steady. In particular, since the fall of 2014, the Fed has just been rolling over its portfolio. As certain bonds mature, they go out and buy new ones and replace them, but their overall position has been neutral from that point forward. So in that respect, my reading is that Yellen, and they raised interest rates also. So I think the Fed is actually trying to tighten, but trying not to cause a crash. And so I believe we're going to see this bubble eventually pop before any dramatic action by the Fed. Let me also just mention, again, this is sort of anecdotal, but in terms of giving us a framework, historically, the five biggest percentage drops in the U.S. stock market all happened in the fourth quarter. And the three biggest drops all happened in an October. All right, so again, if we've primed you to think, yes, there's a crash coming, we just don't know when, it'll probably happen in the fourth quarter. So if it's going to be this year, it's going to be very soon. Maybe we'll get through this year, maybe we won't. We don't have a crystal ball, but I'm just priming you to think that this is partly why we want to deliver you this message right now, because we think it's really urgent. One more thought on this issue of timing. Let's suppose you hear this message, you're intrigued, you start doing research, and boom, the stock market crashes and it's bad. Don't think, oh, I missed it. Too bad I didn't hear about this 6 months ago. Because in the previous, the dot-com crash and the housing bubble crash, yes, there was a big drop, but then the market kept sliding further and further. So in particular, the dot-com crash, the market fell 48% total over 2.5 years. Okay, so when the market finally bottomed out, that was a 2.5 year span. In the 08 crash, the market dropped 50% total, but that happened over 1.5 years. Okay, so again, even if you hear this, we intrigue you and you don't take action and then there's a big drop, don't worry. You still have time to do something that, assuming history repeats itself, that the market would continue coming down. Let me also just mention that in terms of sequencing of events, we're warning about the threat to the dollar and so forth, but the immediate threat we think is to the U.S. equity markets. It is possible that there's a bad crash also in Europe, and that perversely could make the dollar strengthen and treasury yields fall, right, as people panic and rush into the apparent security of the U.S. dollar. So that is consistent with our worldview. We're not saying the dollar is going to crash 6 months from now. We just think that's more of a long-term threat. So in terms of the sequence of these storms, the thing that we think is on the immediate horizon is a drop in U.S. stock markets and real estate markets. But the dollar itself, again, that may strengthen first just because the situation's bad in Europe as well. So just so you understand. Now, one last thing I'll show you. There's going to be a new slide flashing up of what's called the Exeter Pyramid. Let me just explain what this is, and then I'll turn it back over to Carlos. This guy, John Exeter, he wasn't Fed chair, but he was high up in the Federal Reserve hierarchy. And in the 70s, he did a lot of research on financial crises, panics, both in the U.S. and around the world, and just wanted to draw some conclusions, some patterns. And this pyramid is showing the rush to liquidity, all right? And that what happens is you can see from this that the top where it's in red, that's the stuff you don't want to be in if a panic ensues. That stuff drops in value very quickly. And the stuff towards the bottom of the pyramid, is where you want to be. That's the stuff that's going to gain relative, right? So it may be the absolute levels of prices move based on the strength of the currency, but these are showing relative movements in valuation of these types of financial assets. So as you can see, when there's a panic, people rush to things that are liquid. So this idea of liquidity, you could have a house that you say, oh, my house is worth $200,000. You don't mean that tomorrow you could turn that your house into $200,000 in the bank. You mean if I marketed it properly, had 6 months, right? So a house is not very liquid, whereas a share of a major corporate stock, that's pretty liquid. You could call your broker, turn that into cash pretty quickly. So that's the way to think about stuff that you can turn into cash very quickly is the sort of thing that people value when there's a panic and there's uncertainty. They rush to stuff that they know they're not going to have trouble finding a buyer for. And then ultimately, as you see, gold, we could also put silver, the precious metals are at the base of this pyramid, because if a really bad situation happens where even the currency itself is in danger, people rush to the market's money, the historical money, the stuff that people voluntarily use as money, namely gold and silver.
Thanks for listening, everyone. That was the first half of the presentation Carlos, Lara, and I gave at the end of September 2016 on the how to weather the coming financial storms. To remind you, Saturday, October 29th, Nelson, Carlos, and I are going to be in Spokane, Washington for the general public. And then November 15th through 17th, we're going to be in St. Louis participating in a Freedom Advisor event that's intended for financial professionals. So if you want to get more information, go ahead and check out the show notes page for this, which is episode 27 of The Lara Murphy Show. Take care, everybody.
You've just finished another episode of The Lara Murphy Show. Be sure to share this podcast with your friends and colleagues to do your part in building the 10%.
Laura Murphy Show is provided with the understanding that the staff and contributors of LauraMurphy.com are not herein engaged in rendering legal, accounting, tax, or investment advice. On such matters, please consult your own professional tax, legal, or financial advisor.